the microbiota is a collection of organisms that you have in your gut, and then the microbiome is a collection of genes that those organisms have. In this study, they were looking primarily at differences in the microbiota, and what they showed were very large differences in the ratios of two groups of bacteria, the firmicutes and the Bacteroides.
Very different.
One thing that's interesting about that is that the ratio of firmicutes to Bacteroides seems to be important in obesity and Western societies. One thing that's very interesting that I thought they could have explored more in this article.
And the article goes on to infer or observe that the health of the people in Europe versus the people in rural Africa is different.
Essentially in how
for instance,
lean
the people in rural Africa have fewer allergies.
And, whether that
yes, that's right. There's several possible explanations
for that. African children ate
one
a plant-based rural diet of coarse grains. They didn't eat a lot of sugar. They didn't eat a lot of fat. They didn't eat a lot of protein. The European children ate a standard Western diet, but they also ate at least twice as many calories.
There's a lot of variables.
You don't mean with Nintendo and cars and TV.
And some of the work we've been doing with Jeff Gordon's group, sponsored by the Gates Foundation,
messy stuff.
We've been studying
that's exactly right.
And the idea behind the hygiene in Malawi rather than by keeping West African our environments extremely clean, and we see our immune systems become over our American children to things that would otherwise not be a problem. Like
and when you say they look like them a lot, do you mean when you look at them on the street or when you look inside their guts?
It could be that the rural African children have more parasites in their gut, which somehow keeps them from having as many allergies.
Reasons for the institutional
yes,
review
that's
board,
right.
But at
so
least when you're
on
their
strategies,
their gut contents are very similar. And then similarly, the Malawian children to prevent you from having a diet that's predominantly
possible
based on
those
corn,
strategies
rather than
Burkina
Faso, helping our immune system millet,
attacking our own
very different from the children.
And there is some evidence.
Do they eat as many calories as European children do?
If they drink sodas,
do they
eat hot Cheetos and potato chips?
No, there's essentially no processed food in general.
Do they eat a lot of calories or do they eat half as many as most American kids do?
So we eat a lot fewer calories than American kids.
Although there are also
one thing that's really important
in follow-up between
lifestyles and
which we're starting to look at in adults and
may ultimately be able to.
Well, in this study, they weren't looking at those larger things that everybody knows about. They were looking at
the
little tiny guys, the ones
where,
so far, this study
recently
couldn't even
culture them.
Was it the fats?
And they found huge differences between
the high amount of microbiota
in
the
Western diet.
Was it just the total calories?
Was the total calories?
Or is
one of those nutrients
the
driver
study, they were looking
of the change to the kind of microbes that increase the risk of obesity, it seems, and also increase
the
risk of allergies.
Two groups
there
of
are so many differences
the firmicutes and the
Bacteroides isolate.
And one
the
difference
interesting in the
amount
of
each thing
that you eat
and the ratio
of firmicutes
to Bacteroides seems to be important in obesity and Western society.
Yes, you've looked at that yourself. You've looked at that extensively, and those firmicutes and Bacteroides, and those are huge.
If it's a chicken and egg problem,
that we really didn't know much about until we were able to look at their gene snippets.
Well, fascinatingly, in mice at least,
because
the microbes
we culture
can
them
even
in a lab.
Diet.
This is
so
whole
one study we
unmapped
did with
territory.
Wentz's group,
it's amazing, really, the vast majority of microbes
this year.
We know about
in
the environment.
Nobody yet knows how to culture in a lab. And one really interesting question in
those mice,
because they depend on other microbes.
In that case, it wasn't because they were able to extract energy more efficiently from the diet,
but rather because microbes actually made
them together with other
researchers and
like
Jeff Gordon.
And the really amazing
Washington
thing
University
is that we
can transmit
that Cornell
through the microbial community.
We've done
to other
a lot of
we've
so we're
transferring
a lot of work on
the microbial community
and the different
the
kinds of these
bacteria
mice
in the gut.
Genetically
mutated.
One thing that was interesting
to other mice
that they could have
genetically
more in this
completely normal
was
other mice
how much of the
differences
they were seeing between
the
African
and
the European children
high
were due to differences in
even
high body mass index,
differences
in
that
microbial
and how lean or
so it's probably not
how fat they were and whether that could
interplay
some of the differences
between your microbes.
You found in your research that
energy,
when somebody is heavier, they have more
behavior.
Firmicutes in their guts.
Only know about
and in this research, the European
so
children had more
we don't know if
firmicutes also.
But if it does,
what they were observing here is whether or not they had more allergies, and the European children did. The
yeah, that's
African
a lot of
children
exciting
ate
things up
a plant-based rural
this
diet of coarse grains. They didn't eat a lot of sugar.
Say,
they didn't eat a lot of fat. They didn't eat a lot of protein. The European children ate a standard Western diet. But they also ate at least twice as many calories, at least twice as many calories. So there's a lot of variables there.
And it's always difficult to untangle those variables. In some of the work we've been doing with Jeff Gordon's group, sponsored by the Gates Foundation, we've been studying an East African population in Malawi rather than the West African population that was studied here. And we see very similar trends. So our American children look a lot like the European children reported in this study.
And when you say they look like them a lot, do you mean when you look at them on the street or when you look inside their guts at their firmicutes?
Well, I can't tell you how they look on the street for confidentiality reasons with the Institutional Review Board, but at least when you look in their guts, their gut contents are very similar. And then similarly, the Malawian children who have a diet that's predominantly based on corn rather than in Burkina Faso, where I think it was mostly millet, they look very different from the children on the Western diet.
Do they eat as many calories as European children do? Do they drink sodas? Do they eat hot Cheetos and potato chips?
No, there's essentially no processed food in their diet.
Do they eat a lot of calories, or do they eat half as many as most American kids do?
They also eat a lot fewer calories than American kids do. And so one thing that's really important for follow-up studies, which we're starting to look at in adults and may ultimately be able to move into children, is trying to isolate the effect of the number of calories that you eat from which particular calories you're eating. And so there's a bunch of studies in progress on that at the moment with different collaborators. One thing that's interesting is just how different the microbiota is in small children than it is in older children or in adults. One thing they noticed in this study is that the very young children from both Europe and Africa tended to cluster together, whereas it was only the older children where there started to be that differentiation in the ratio of the main types of bacteria.
The babies, a lot of them were breastfed, and during the time the babies are breastfed, microbes in their guts are somewhat similar.
The length of breastfeeding is yet another difference between the two populations, which gives you an idea of how difficult it is to untangle all those factors. One really important question is what implications breastfeeding has for microbial health in the gut, as well as all the other factors in health that breastfeeding is implicated in.
And if you fast forward to when the children are growing up, yes, they do eat more calories in the United States and Europe, but the kind they eat is different too. And so far, this study doesn't look at, was it the fats? Was it the sugars? Was it the high amount of protein in the Western diet? Was it just the total calories? Or is one of those nutrients a driver of the change to the kind of microbes that increase the risk of obesity, it seems, and also increase the risk of allergies?
There are so many differences at this point. They're trying to isolate the differences in the amount of each thing that you eat and then the kind of fat that you eat, whether it's trans fats or unsaturated or saturated fats. We just don't know at this point what effect each of those factors has on the gut microbes, although we are gaining increasing evidence that the gut microbes could be very important for health.
If it's a chicken and egg problem, which comes first, the microbes or the diet?
Well, fascinatingly, in mice at least, the microbes can even affect the diet. So one study we did with Andrew Gewitz's group at Emory that was reported in Science earlier this year, in that case, there was a genetic mutation in a gene called TLR5 that triggered a change in the gut microbiology in those mice. Those mice became obese, but in that case, it wasn't because they were able to extract energy more efficiently from the diet, but rather because microbes actually made them hungrier and made them eat more. And the really amazing thing is that we could transmit that through the microbial community to other mice. And so by transferring the microbial community in the gut from these mice that were genetically mutated to other mice that were genetically completely normal, those other mice also became hungrier and ate more and became obese and had high triglycerides, high cholesterol, and even high blood pressure after receiving that microbial transplant. So it's probably not a cause-effect thing. It's probably the cyclic interplay between your microbes and how efficiently you're able to extract energy and possibly even host behavior. I should point out that we only know about those effects in host behavior in mice so far. We don't know if this applies to humans, but if it does, it could certainly have profound implications.
Okay, so backing up a little bit, what we eat may make a difference in our microbes, but also perhaps who you hang out with. There might be a little bit of microbial cross-transference between friends. So if I hang out with someone with high blood pressure, it's a chance that I could get microbial high blood pressure inhabitants in my body?
That's going a little further than what the research currently supports, but it is true that people who know a lot of other people who are obese tend to be obese themselves. And so one question is how much of that is resetting things like the amount you eat or what you think about your body image or so forth, depending on the people around you. But another possibility is that there is some direct transmission of microbes that are associated with some of these phenomena. And it's going to be a fascinating area for research over the coming years.
Are you thinking at this point that when people get organ transplants, in most cases the blood type and all of this other stuff has to match, but there's the exception. Husband and wife, sometimes their organs will be totally accepted. Like if I need a kidney and my husband was so kind as to give me a kidney, it would probably work. Could that be because we've shared our microbes long enough?
Now, that's a really interesting question, because there is some recent work from Jeremy Nicholson at Imperial College in the UK looking at how the microbes in your gut can completely change your metabolism. And so, for example, the way you metabolize drugs like Tylenol can be very, very different and have different effects on toxicity depending on what microbes are in your gut, what pathways are used to break those drugs down. And then there's some there's systematic effects on gene expression in the rest of the body once those small molecules get into the bloodstream. What I thought you were going to ask about is, you've probably seen in the news recently the work on stool transplants for Clostridium difficile.
Oh, that's the work of Dr. Ose up in Minnesota. You know, someday I'd like to see if you all can get together and look at this together.
That'd be very exciting. Janet Jansen, who's one of the editors of the ESME Journal, one of the good journals in this field, has been collaborating with that group looking at the microbes. What they've seen, when they look directly at the microbes that are either associated with successful treatment of Clostridium difficile or unsuccessful treatment, and in a successful treatment, the microbes from the stool donor really do transfer in the gut of the recipient. One thing that's interesting there is that typically the donor is a close relative or a family member, but we don't actually know for sure whether family members who live together have more similar microbes. So it's really interesting. Again, in some work we did with Jeff Gordon's group, what we saw is that identical twins, so monozygotic twins, do indeed have more similar gut microbes than unrelated individuals do. So these are adult twins living apart, typically in their late 20s, early 30s. But one thing that was really interesting is that identical twins did not have more similar gut microbes than non-identical twins. On the face of it, that would tell you that they were just inheriting it from their mothers, for example, rather than there being a strong genetic effect.
Oh, you're saying that because they were both in the womb together and they both entered the world through the same birth canal at the same time, that may have started the road to what their microbes would be that lasted a lifetime.
And it's interesting that you bring up the birth canal, because in some work we did earlier this year with Maria Gloria Dominguez at the University of Puerto Rico, also some collaborators in Venezuela, we find that when you look at babies 20 minutes after birth, so in adults, the different body habitats have extremely different microbial communities from one another. So what's in your mouth versus what's in your hand, that can be as different as what's in dirt versus what's in seawater, right? Totally different microbial communities. But 20 minutes after birth, lots of different habitats in the baby, so the mouth, the skin, even the meconium, which is the first feces the baby produces, all of those basically look the same, right? They're undifferentiated. And if the baby came out the regular way, all of those microbes look like the vaginal microbial community, specifically like the mother's vagina. Whereas if the baby's delivered by C-section, all of those communities look more or less like skin. And not specifically the mother's skin, but then at least in that hospital, apparently it's frequently the father who holds the baby immediately after birth. Unfortunately, Maria Gloria did not have IRB permission to sample the fathers, so we'll have to check that out in a follow-up study.
Well, all of this is so fascinating. I suppose my final question for today should be, how can I check to see if I've got Firmicutes in me or Bacteroidetes?
You almost certainly have both of those, because everyone we've looked at all over the world has had Firmicutes. And Bacteroidetes, we have seen very occasionally individuals without them, but typically people who have diarrhea or other proteobacterial infections. So I would be very surprised if you were lacking either of those two major groups.
I suppose the better question is, how can I tell if I have the healthy ratio of these kind of microbes in my gut? Is this something that anybody can find out right now?
There's no commercial services that will let you find that out. The way we find it out for research purposes is that we would take a stool sample and extract the DNA from the stool, and then we would amplify one small piece of one particular kind of gene using a reaction called the polymerase chain reaction to make lots of copies of it. And then we would take those and we would sequence them on what's called a next generation sequencer. What's great about that is that you get back about a million sequences every time you run that instrument, and you do it directly from the DNA itself. Whereas before, with the old kind of sequencing, like the sequencing that was used to map the human genome initially, you would have to take each of those pieces of DNA and clone it into a different bacterium, and then grow colonies of bacteria and actually pick out those colonies with a toothpick, and then grow each colony in pure culture. and then sequence the many copies of that gene from that colony. And so you can imagine that with a million of those, you'd need a million toothpicks and then a million little cloning vials and so forth. And it would get very, very labor-intensive and very time-consuming. Whereas now, because we can do it directly at the molecular level, we save a lot of time and a lot of expense. So it is literally millions of times cheaper to do this kind of experiment now than it was back in 2001 when the human genome was mapped. Given the rate that the technology is progressing, it's likely that it's going to be another factor of 10 cheaper next year, and the cost is just declining. It's one thing that's amazing about this, you probably saw in the news the reports of how there were now over 5 billion cell phones activated on Earth, which is amazing when you think about it, when there's only about 7 billion people, right? Anywhere you go, including in countries in Africa and South Asia and South America and other places that we're studying for this Gates Foundation project, everywhere you go, you see people with cell phones. And the reason for that is Moore's Law, the very rapid decrease in the cost of computer processing power over time. But one thing that's been decreasing in cost even faster than that is DNA sequencing. So we believe that DNA sequencing is going to be one of those technologies that's available to everyone and just about too cheap to meter. And when are there going to be consumer-level tests available? And I think the answer to that is that we need more research to figure out what kinds of bacteria are the ones that are really good and what kinds are really bad. Because just one of those groups, like the firmicutes, that has about as much diversity at the molecular level as all the plants, all the animals, and all the fungi combined, right? It's a very broad group of bacteria. And trying to find out within that group the particular kinds of bacteria that are good or bad is going to continue to be a challenge.
You're just looking to see what's there right now. You have no idea what it means. Not really. Not yet.
Well, we have some idea what it means, but you're right. There's an awful lot of research still to do. One thing that makes it so complicated is that just like in ecosystems that you can go out and see around you, there's all these cases where different species can play the same functional role. A lot of what makes it challenging is that different people who have different microbes could have different combinations of microbes that do the same thing. So a lot of these projects are much more like ecology projects than they are like a traditional microbiology project where you'd grow one thing on a petri dish and do some biochemistry on it to understand it. We really have to do this at the whole community level. Norm Pace, who's one of the faculty here at Boulder and won a MacArthur Genius Award for doing this kind of research, has compared traditional microbiology to trying to understand the rainforest by going to the zoo and looking at every animal in its individual cage, right? It's very difficult to understand species that way when you can't see the interactions between them.
Well, it sounds to me like the work that you're doing is a step or two behind proteomics, for instance, right now. We know a bit more about our proteins and our protein expression in the body. That's getting more affordable to check. We're on the verge of having tests where somebody could look at 500 proteins, and even the FDA would say, this means that you're at risk for heart disease. And if these proteins can change with something that you do, you might be at lower risk. That's what's starting to happen in that field. And you're right behind that with all these little microbes.
One thing, of course, is that the human proteome is a lot less complex than the microbial proteome because you only have proteins that are made from the 20,000 or so genes encoded by your human genome. And then you have about 10 trillion human cells associated with what you like to think of as your body. But then there's about 100 trillion microbial cells in there. They're probably from 1,000 different species. If each of those 1,000 species has about 2,000 genes, which is about average, then you're talking about 2 million distinct genes making up that system, as opposed to only about 20,000 genes in the human genome. So part of the reason that we're not quite at the stage of diagnostic tests yet is that the complexity in the gut is so much greater than the complexity in the human proteome. However, remember that outside of Star Trek, it's really hard to change your genome, whereas each of us has profoundly changed our microbial community from the time we were born up until the time we're adults. And probably it's a lot easier to change your microbes than it is to change your own genome. While it's true that understanding the microbiome is very complicated, there's also the hope that it will be a lot easier to alter than trying to alter things based on host gene expression. So a large part of the challenge is understanding those ecological rules to figure out what direction we can change things in and to try to figure out how we can apply the right care and feeding to our microbes to produce the outcomes that we want.
The right care and feeding. Well, thank you. And I'm intrigued that you're intrigued by Dr. Ose. Are you working directly with him at this point, or are you watching what's happening with your other colleague and him?
Just watching what's happening with interest. It's certainly fascinating research, though.
It's fascinating partly because it's just a little teaspoon of filtered stool that's inoculated through the stomach. And yet, as you said, if it takes hold, it
transforms an entire microbial community. That's very intriguing.
That's right. And the studies of large ecosystems have certainly shown that tiny inoculations of species can have huge effects. So I'm from New Zealand originally, and we have a huge problem there with introduced mammals of different kinds. For example, possums, only about half a dozen breeding pairs were introduced in the 19th century, introduced from Australia to start off a fur trade. Now there's about 70 million of them, destroying all sorts of native plants and native birds that are not adapted to deal with them. Then an example a bit closer to home is the wolves in Yellowstone, right? Where reintroducing wolves to the Yellowstone ecosystem has had these profound changes in reforestation, even things like what kinds of fish are likely to live in the streams, in part because of changes to the behavior of the herbivores. Even the elk changed their habits a lot when the wolves were around. And so one thing we have to worry about with these microbial studies is if you went to Yellowstone and just took a cubic mile of material and ground it up, you wouldn't find a lot of wolf DNA in there, right? One thing that is really interesting is the possibility of these keystone species that are there at very low abundance in the gut that will need more sensitive techniques to detect and better experimental methods to find.
You mean you haven't seen them yet? They're not the kind that your research would find yet, because you have to have huge numbers of the DNA snippet to be able to say, aha, this is part of what's in this community. You can't find the ones that are just the rare lone wolf.
That's exactly right. And what we're looking at the moment is really the most common species in the gut ecosystem. And to a large extent, that's okay, right? Because if you go up in the Flatirons and you look around you and you guess that pine trees, which you're going to see everywhere, are important, that's a pretty good guess. But the things that are also important but very rare are still difficult to get at the moment. It'll be a while before we get a full understanding of what's going on in ecosystems as complex as the gut.
Well, when we talk about Dr. Ose and his research, he's talking about a disease where the disease C. diff colitis is a deadly disease that oftentimes is triggered by someone taking one kind of antibiotic after another. And so really the medications they've had, it's an iatrogenic disease. It's caused by treating it with antibiotics. It wipes out their whole microbial community. And then some bullies come in, some microbial bullies, and they take over kind of like crabgrass.
It's really one of these kinds of things where you have an organism that's at low abundance in most people, and most people are fine, and then occasionally it's just able to take over, like crabgrass, as you say, or similar to Staph aureus in the skin, where a lot of people have it, but they're asymptomatic. One piece of research that we're doing at the moment, coming out in Genome Research, I think next week, is a collaboration with a Spanish group looking at rats and trying to figure out whether antibiotics actually help in the stool transplant process or whether they hinder it. We had expected that if you added antibiotics, that would clear out the bacteria in the gut that the recipient rats already had and make it easier for new bacteria to colonize. But what we found was that instead, the antibiotics were especially effective at wiping out those newly transplanted bacteria, and that the amount of colonization was actually less if we did antibiotics and then did the transplant than if we did the transplant by itself. What's so surprising about all this research is that, in general, we don't know enough yet to predict what's going to happen, right? So we can often explain things after the fact, like it makes sense that those newly transplanted microbes might be especially vulnerable, but there's going to be a lot of additional research that needs to be done to really be able to apply a lot of these findings in the clinic.
If I have a grass lawn that's full of weeds, I'll be told to kill everything before I replant the seeds for the new grass so that there's more chance for the new grass to take over the way I want. You tried the same thing with the rats. You tried to kill everything in their guts so that the implant would work better of the new stool. And in fact, they didn't fare as well as the ones where you just took them at the state they were and did a stool transplant for them. That's such a strange word, but that's what we're calling it, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right.
And it worked better.
Yeah, that's right. The overprescription of antibiotics is really a huge public health problem at the moment. On the one hand, antibiotics are among those kinds of miracle drugs that have completely transformed medicine and healthcare and saved a lot of lives. But on the other hand, the overuse of antibiotics is really leading to some large public health threats at the moment. And figuring out how to treat a lot of these kinds of infections from an ecological perspective rather than from a chemical perspective, I think is going to be really important.
So, Rob Knight, you're thinking that someday you might do, we're calling them stool transplants, but microbial transplants through the nose so that it goes all the way through the peristalsis, meaning all of the ways that the body squishes things down through the whole digestive tract. You're thinking that someday you might do that for all kinds of conditions, possibly.
That's right. And the work with the babies that we talked about earlier is one particularly interesting type, because you know, historically there was only one way that you were going to come out if your mother and survive, right? And so it's very plausible that the vaginal community is specifically adapted to coat babies with microbes that they need to avoid things like skin infections, which are quite a lot more common in babies delivered by C-section. One really interesting possibility is that as we find more about the natural bacteria that that we're supposed to have on different parts of our body, that we'll be able to figure out when those bacterial communities are going wrong in some way, whether because of an advance in medical technology or because we're overcleaning ourselves, be able to correct some of those imbalances to improve health.
Yeah, so whether it's how we eat and we change how we eat, or we change who we hang out with because the person, you know, what's your blood type, that kind of question, are people compatible? The new question will be, what are your microbes? And will I hang out with you or not because your microbes are good for me? And the other is this one about inoculating ourselves on the skin surface through our digestive tract with the microbes we need. Wild.
Yeah, there's a lot of exciting things coming up in this field. Microbial cells are the majority of the cells in your body, so it makes sense not to continue ignoring them.